Well, last week, at the end of the teaching, we took a little rabbi trail and we talked about women and the power of a woman. And I had a lot of conversations and calls from people that it just, they found it very helpful and they loved the picture I put up last week. And so there were a number of things I still wanted to say about that. So I thought, you know what, we're going to continue that topic just a little bit during the teaching today, if you don't mind, and bring out a few more things. Because some of the people, some of the ladies said, I still didn't quite catch what the power of a woman was. You said you're going to tell us what the true power of a woman is, because women are powerful. But their power doesn't lie where most women think it does. So if you didn't quite catch where the power of a woman lies, where your power lies as a female, then hopefully we'll make that perfectly clear to you today. So let's start with this. This is something I didn't have time to share last week. I had the overhead ready, this is a powerful verse. Proverbs 11:22, like a gold ring and a pig's snout, get the picture. You have this big sow hog here, all right? I remember as a kid in Tennessee, my grandfather raised pigs. These things are monstrous. They look like elephants with their trunks removed. I mean, they were just big, pink. They were amazing. And now picture that, the gold ring in the snout, all right? Picture that, get that image there. Like a gold ring and a pig's snout is a beautiful woman without discretion. Now, when you look at the picture and the imagery, it doesn't quite seem to fit, because he's saying that the golden ring is representative of a woman's beauty. And yet the ring is a very tiny thing compared to the big naked pig. Whereas we think of a woman's beauty as going from her hair right down to her toenails. I mean, a beautiful woman is a beautiful woman. And she's just covered. She's adorned in beauty. And yet, Solomon is saying that all of that beauty is nothing more than a little tiny gold ring and the pig's nose, if the woman lacks discretion. And her indiscretion is the pig. You follow? And what really shows in the spiritual realm is not her physical beauty. That's tiny. It's precious since a gift of God, but it's tiny. What shows is her pigginess. That is what's obvious. And if you spend time with a beautiful woman who lacks discretion, her pig nature quickly shows itself and is repulsive. And what looks beautiful on the outside becomes repulsive instead. And you know, the reverse of this is true. I've met some women who weren't endowed with a great physical beauty, but when their spirits, their souls showed through, they became beautiful. They became ravishing. And we have to remember that the physical beauty on the outside is just skin deep. But as my dad used to say, ugly goes all the way to the bone. And there's a saying I came across this week. It says, if you're beautiful at 16, you can take no credit for it. But if you're still beautiful at 60, it's your own soul's doing. So what is the secret to a woman's beauty? It's also the secret to her true power. The scriptures gives us many hints. And here's a saying I came across too. When a woman covers her body, it is easier to see her soul. The power of a woman is not in her sexuality. Oh, she can have power over a man who's an animal. And as I said last week, a woman can use, if she reveals a lot of skin, she can stir the animal. But as she begins to reveal her soul, she stirs the man. Another quote I came across this week, I came across a lot of these as I was reading, thinking, and one was, is that men are not animals. They're just very easily distracted souls. And that is very true. Psalm 45:13. Two lines. This verse consists of two lines. Let's look at the first line. And I'm not sure how your translation translates this psalm. I find that most English translations, they're all over the board, because this is Hebrew poetry, and to try to make the poetry make sense, they sometimes meddle with the literal wording of the poem. But this is as literal as I can get the translation. Here's what it is. All the glory of the king's daughter is within, or internal. All the glory of the king's daughter is within. You got that? The glory of the king's daughter. Women, you want to be a daughter of the king? Your glory is not on the outside. Your glory is within. It's internal. Because that's where the true power of a woman is. But look at the next line. Her clothing, now it talks about the exterior. Her clothing is interwoven with gold. Now compare that to what David's son wrote. Like a gold ring in a pig's snout is a beautiful woman without discretion. What do you want to do? You want to be a pig with a ring in your nose? That ring is not hiding the fact you're still a pig. A little ring in your nose is not much of a disguise. And it's not going to fool anybody except a fool. But the daughter of the king, her glory is not some ring stuck in her nose. Her glory is within. But her clothing is interwoven with gold. Because she's the king's daughter, because of her relationship to the king, and because of the glory placed within her, she is covered in beautiful, glorious modesty. And gold covers all of her. She's not a pig. So, women, the secret to your power, and you are powerful, is all internal. It's in your soul. But if you're always showing skin, men are not going to see your soul. Now, I know that a woman can dress immodestly and maybe not affect her spirituality. But I'm telling you something, ladies, speaking as a man, it affects ours. And if you want to bring out the best in a man, then you use the power within you, which is hidden inside your soul. Here's another verse. Here's one from the New Testament. 1 Peter. Your beauty, he's speaking to women, your beauty should not consist in externals. Now, this does not mean women should not wear beautiful clothing. I think they should. It doesn't mean women should not wear jewelry. I buy my wife jewelry, not all the time, probably not as often as she'd like, but I do buy her jewelry. It doesn't mean a woman should not fix her hair in a nice, beautiful, fashionable, modest way. Of course. You know, I don't see modesty as a woman putting on a uniform. I mean, when you look at the Amish women, Mennonite women, God bless them. I'm not criticizing. But you see, when you just put on a uniform, and like Pentecostal women, I remember Pentecostal girls at the school, they just dressed in these long, like, sackcloth and hair all piled way up and no makeup, no jewelry. And I thought, you see, if you just put on a uniform, remember how I always talk about how we find comfort in extremes, we gravitate to extremes? See, when you're in extreme, you don't have to think anymore. You put on the uniform, you go about your business. God does not want us to be mindless. He wants us modest. But we can be very creative with that modesty and still be modest. You can measure the length of a skirt line. You can measure the length of a sleeve. But you can't really measure modesty. It's something that's intangible. But you know it when you see it. And you know it when it's missing. And when it's missing, I don't care how beautiful the woman is, she's a pig. Nice ring. Your beauty should not consist in externals. Rather, let it be the what? Hidden person in your heart. The hidden person in your heart. With the imperishable. Now, this is a very important thing, especially for women. Because you know how it is, the beauty doesn't last. The ugly does. But the beauty doesn't last. But here's the true beauty of a woman that endures. It is imperishable and it grows. It grows. It's the imperishable quality of a gentle and quiet spirit. Remember the picture last week? There was a powerful woman. And the knight is kneeling in front of her. She has power over him. He could take her in a fight, like I said last week, but she wields the power. He may have the physical strength. She has the spiritual. And he kneels before her, and he is not ashamed. That's the day he's been living for. But she didn't do it by showing a little leg. She did it by revealing the hidden person in her heart. The adventure of marriage is not knowing one another physically. That is a part of it. But the ongoing adventure, I know for Robin and me, it'll be 31 years for us in August. But for Robin and me, the adventure is getting to know her soul. And I'm still figuring this woman out. I'm still mapping out her soul, and I feel like I've hardly scratched the surface. And it is an adventure of a lifetime. I hope I'm not embarrassing you. But anyways, I mean, all of this is a compliment. And women, this is where your true power is. This is where your true power is. A gentle and quiet spirit. You think, how can gentle and quiet be powerful? Well, Yeshua was gentle. And he's pretty quiet. Atoms are small and quiet, but we make nuclear bombs out of them. The secret to spiritual power is always smallness and anonymity. And if you don't believe it, then you should. Because God uses one of the tiniest countries in the world to turn the world on its head, as we see in current events. He uses one of the smallest people groups in the world to bring forth most of the inventions, the technology, the medicine, the art, the music, all of the wonderful things we enjoy in this world. 90% or more come from this little tiny group of people called the Jewish people. This little tiny group, this little speck of people that the enemy has tried to wipe out time after time after time after time, but just can't seem to do it. Other nations have perished, but this little people endures. And boy, I tell you what, if you don't realize that smallness and anonymity is the secret to spiritual power, you haven't read the Bible. I mean, think about it. A carpenter from Nazareth who never wrote a word, who basically invested in 12 people, and one of them didn't turn out so well. And here we are today, over 2,000 years later, following him, yielding our lives to him, pledging our allegiance to this Messiah. Come on. This is powerful stuff. This is where your power lies. You know, when Paul says, I don't suffer a woman to speak in the church, but they are to maintain silence, he's not putting down the woman. What it really says in the Greek there is basically, the essence of it is they are to be the guardians of the silence. In other words, he's saying, men, here's your job. I want the children to watch you and learn how to talk. Women, here's your job, and it might even be more important. I want you to model silence, gentleness, stillness of spirit, because your children need to learn that as well. And if they don't, they're going to be in trouble. He's given both of us very important jobs to do. And why did he assign them that way? Because we tend to flip-flop them. Men are content to come in a group and say nothing and let the women do the talking. You ever notice on an interview on TV and there's a couple sitting there? Who does the talking? The woman does. And the guy's content to let her. This is upside down. You know, the secret to woman's power being hidden is also reflected in our biology. A woman's reproductive organs are internal. A man's are external. Her power is inside. It's even reflected in the very makeup of her body. In the Midrash Rabbah, the ancient Bible studies, these were Bible studies that Yeshua was familiar with. In his commentary on Ruth, it says, each generation is redeemed by its righteous women. Women set the tone for a home, for family, for a city, for a nation. It really is true. And when women forget what their power is, and they decide, I'm going to be like a guy. You've traded in something powerful for something that's not. You've traded in your highest calling for something you're not called to do at all. And you're leaving something that is glorious behind, and you decide, you know what, I'm going to be a pig and put a ring in my nose. Instead of being the daughter of the king, whose glory is all internal. But she's dressed in clothing that is interwoven with gold. Hold those two pictures in front of you, ladies. Here's gold and here's gold, but this is a ring and a pig's nose. This is a daughter of a king. This is the princess who's wearing these glorious articles of clothing interwoven with gold. There's your choice. Which one's powerful? Which one's powerful? You know, a man can be attracted to a woman physically, and there's a flash in the pan, and it's over. There's nothing to build a relationship on. Or a man can be attracted to a woman internally and eternally and deeply, and something that grows and gets stronger and never wanes. But it's in the woman's hand as to what she's going to be. It's in the woman's hand. She kind of decides that. And I want you to remember this. I should have put this in overhead so you can see it and write it down. This is by a Jewish lady, Gina Mandelson. I just finished a book that Robin gave me that I think April recommended, excellent book called Outside Inside. Listen to what she says. She's talking about women in regard to men. It says, in asking others to seek the real you. In other words, my glory is all inside of here. When in asking others to seek the real you, you challenge them to define the real them. Girls, you can show a lot of skin and flirt and attract a male. Or you can be modest, a little quieter than normal, and you can attract a man. Because as that man becomes enthralled with you, with your soul, he begins to seek out who you are. It causes him to define himself. It causes him to analyze himself. Because as he begins to know who you are, it calls it the deep things in him. Deep calls to deep, the word tells us. And it's going to bring out the best in us. This is the same thing Messiah does with his bride. We're told to seek his face, right? Because he has sought us. He came to seek and to save that which is lost. He has sought us out and we seek him out. There's this mutual searching out of the heart of another. And as we get to know him better, we find him becoming more one with us. There's a knitting together. But you know, none of us have ever seen him. All we have are his love letters. We have his proposal, we have his promises, we have his oath. But there's been no physical contact with our Messiah. Because he works from the inside out. So the question is, are you willing to model that same sort of relationship with that special guy, that special girl? But there's the wedding supper of the Lamb. Oh my goodness, can you imagine what a party that's going to be? And then not only will we see him, we'll see him as he is. We will be one with him. He will be our God. We will be his people. And we will be one forever. Nothing's ever going to change it. That's going to be an incredible thing. So anyways, I just want to add a few more thoughts. Women, your power is not in your sexuality. Besides that, I mentioned last week, sex is biological. Sexuality, though, true sexuality, is spiritual. It doesn't dry up and go away. Something emanates from the very spirit of a woman. In fact, biologically, it's interesting. Scientists have begun to discover that sex is something women have and men don't. Sexuality is something that is absolutely, completely, and totally feminine. Scientists, I don't know how they come up with this, but I read this fascinating article years ago. They said sexuality is something a woman has and a man does not. A guy is just a guy is just a guy. But everything about sexuality itself is something that God has deposited within the soul of a woman. Something interesting to think about. Sexuality itself is truly a spiritual thing, not just biological. All right? Well, let's move on. Let's go to our Torah portion. Our Torah portion begins in Numbers chapter 13, but we are going to pick it up and in verse 21. No, actually verse 25. Verse 25. These 12 men, these 12 spies, and by the way, even though the translation says spies, the word is not spies. Joshua later sends out two spies, and the word there is raglim. It means spies, but these are not spies. The word spy is not used in reference to these. The word here is vaturu. That's where we get our English word tour. I want you to take a tour of the land. I just want you to go see the sights. You're not there to spy. You're there just to go see the sights, bring us back a report, tell us about the trip. Joshua sends out two spies. Not 12, just two, to go to Jericho. And that's actually our Haftorah reading for this week. But we'll use the word spy because that's what most translations have. So he picks 12 spies. Moses picks one from each tribe. And remember, it was not God's idea to send the spies. We find out later in Deuteronomy 1, verse 22, that the people approached Moses asking him to send some spies in the land, to send some people in to tour it. Was not God's idea, wasn't Moses' idea. It was the people's idea. That's not revealed to us in Numbers. We find that in Deuteronomy 1:22. So he picks a leader from each tribe. And these leaders are described back in the early part of the portion. They were leaders, they were distinguished men, they were heads of the children of Israel. He sends them. Verse 25, these 12 spies, after a 40-day period, they return. It says, they returned from exploring the land at the end of 40 days. They went and came to Moses and to Aaron and to the entire assembly of the children of Israel, to the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh, and brought back the report to them and the entire assembly, and they showed them the fruit of the land. They reported to him and said, we arrived at the land to which you sent us, and indeed it flows with milk and honey. If only they'd stop there. Oh, and this is its fruit. They brought this huge cluster of grapes. They weren't huge grapes. It was a huge cluster of grapes, all right? I don't want you to picture these big mutant grapes, all right? That's not what it was. They were maybe big, but the cluster itself is what was so huge. They'd use two poles to carry it. And this is its fruit. Verse 28, but. Interesting word about thing about that word but. The word but here is ephes. Ephes. In Hebrew, it has two meanings. One is but. The other meaning is zero. You know, when people flatter you, they'll say this and this and this and this, and then they'll say but. And everything before the but is zero. All right? Because now they're getting ready to tell you what they really think. But it's almost like when they use that word but, it wiped out everything they said before. Everything he said before, it just became a zero. But the people that dwells in the land is powerful. The cities are very greatly fortified. We also saw there the offspring of the giant. Amalek dwells in the area of the south. The Hittite, the Jebusite, the Amorite dwell on the mountain. And the Canaanite dwells by the sea and on the bank of the Jordan. Caleb silenced the people toward Moses and said, we shall surely ascend and conquer it, for we can surely do it. He speaks eight words, and those eight words saved his life. But the men who had ascended with him said, we cannot ascend to that people, for it is too strong for us. And the moment they said that, those words became true. Their children would go up. They weren't too strong for their kids. What's interesting about that word for us, in Hebrew it's one word. Memenu, for us. But you can pronounce that same word, memeno, that means for him. And when you're saying, when God gives you an order, and you say, oh, no, the hurdle is too great, the task is too great for me, you're really saying it's too great for you. That's really what you're saying, because the word means both. Verse 32, they brought forth to the children of Israel an evil report on the land that they had spied out, saying, the land through which we have passed to spy it out is a land that devours its inhabitants. Keep that phrase in mind, because later Joshua says, they are our bread, we'll devour them. But these people say, they'll devour us. It devours its inhabitants. All the people that we saw in it were huge. There we saw the Nephilim, the sons of the giant from among the Nephilim. Now, we're not sure if that's really true, because we don't find any mention of the Nephilim in the Bible after the flood, except here. I think they're exaggerating. I don't really think they're Nephilim at all. There might have been some big guys there. But as far as children of the Nephilim, there's no support for that in Scripture. All we have is the word of these spies. We know they exaggerate and lie. We were like grasshoppers in our eyes, and so we were in their eyes. My question is, but how about God's eyes? See, they're looking at everything from a purely human perspective, and they're leaving God completely out of the formula. So chapter 14, verse 1, the entire assembly raised up and issued its voice. The people wept that night. All the children of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron and the entire... It's interesting. It doesn't say they murmured against God, though God did take it personally. And this is what we tend to do. When we have a gripe against God, we usually don't gripe against him. We'll gripe against his representative. Isn't that what we do? But they murmured against Moses and Aaron, and the entire assembly said to them, if only we had died in the land of Egypt, or if only we had died in this wilderness. And I think God was thinking, that can be arranged. In fact, they did all die in the wilderness. They got their wish. Why is Adonai bringing us to this land to die by the sword? Now here's what's interesting. If only we had died in Egypt, if we had died in the wilderness, but we don't want to die there. You know, if you're going to die, does it make much difference where? And wouldn't you rather die at least trying to conquer the land God's called you to than as a whiner or as a slave? This is what's so amazing. Their very words give the lie to their hearts. It exposes their hearts for how deceptive they are. Our wives and young children will be taken captive. Actually, their children are going to go in and take the Canaanites captive. Is it not better for us to return to Egypt? No. Dumb question. So they said to one another, let us appoint a leader and let us return to Egypt. Moses and Aaron fell on their faces before the entire congregation of the assembly of the children of Israel. You know, this is interesting. Think about that. Let us appoint a leader. If you're appointing the leader, is he really a leader? But when God is the leader and God appoints leaders, they're really leaders. I read a quote by Einstein this last week. He says there are two things that are infinite. The universe and human stupidity, and I'm not sure about the universe. But anyways, Moses and Aaron fell on their faces before the entire congregation of the assembly of the children of Israel. Joshua, son of Nun, and Caleb, son of Jephunneh, of the spies of the land, tore their garments, their mourning. They realized this is not good. They spoke to the entire assembly of the children of Israel, saying, the land that we passed through to spy it out, the land is very, very good. If Adonai desires us, he will bring us to this land and give it to us, a land that flows with milk and honey. But do not rebel against Adonai. You should not fear the people of the land, for they are our bread. They won't devour us. They're our bread. Their protection has departed from them. Interesting, that word for protection in Hebrew is the word zelem, which means shadow. shadow. You know, God provided a cloud to overshadow the people because it protected them. It was their protection against the sun. And the sages say there's also protection against the snakes and animals, that as the cloud came, everything else just kind of went away. Well, what is it that makes a shadow disappear? Light. So Joshua is saying here, in essence, their protection, their shadow is gone. Why? Because the light of God is coming in. Their protection, their shadow is departed from them. Adonai is with us. Do not fear them. But the entire assembly said to pelt them with stones. They were ready to kill Joshua and Caleb. And the glory of Adonai appeared. All of a sudden, God shows up. Well, he's been there, but he makes his presence obvious and apparent. And the tent of meeting to all the children of Israel. And I'm sure they're starting to think, uh-oh. Adonai said to Moses, how long will this people provoke me? And how long will they not have faith in me? Despite all the signs that I performed in their midst. And then he once again, for the second time, offers Moses, you know, I can just annihilate them and I can make out of you a family of people that can be my people. And once again, Moses intercedes. And once again, God relents. And we'll go on down to verse 20 for the sake of time. And Adonai said, I have forgiven because of your words. But as I live, and the glory of Adonai shall fill the entire world. Now, that's an interesting phrase. If that phrase, and the glory of Adonai shall fill the entire world, if that were left out, you wouldn't notice something missing. So when you see a phrase like that just stuck in, there's something very, very powerful and very insightful there. But as I live, and then little parentheses, and the glory of Adonai shall fill the entire world. In other words, God is saying, listen, this going in to conquer Canaan, this is just step one. That's where I go to establish my land, my capital, my people, my temple. And from there, I'm going to fill the entire earth. You see? And if you can't take step one with me, how are you going to fulfill the destiny I have appointed for this people of Israel? You're going to let a few tall people scare you away? You're going to let some walls frighten you off? After all I've demonstrated to you, and my glory is going to fill the world, the whole world is going to be mine. But anyways, verse 22, that all the men who have seen my glory and my signs are performed in Egypt and in the wilderness and have tested me these 10 times and have not heeded my voice. If they will see the land that I have sworn to give their forefathers, and all who anger me shall not see it, except my servant Caleb, because a different spirit was with them and followed me wholeheartedly. I shall bring him to the land to which he came. And his offspring shall possess it. I'm going to show you a little something about Caleb's name. I didn't plan to do this, but it just struck me as a thing to do. Here's the name Caleb in Hebrew. Kaf Lamed Beit. Okay? Now, we break this into two words. Kaf Lamed spells the word all, or whole, or complete. The second two letters, Lamed Beit, spells what? Heart. So when you pronounce this word Kalev, it's the name Caleb, and it means complete heart, a whole heart. The entire heart. And even says of Caleb down in verse 24, but my servant Caleb, because a different spirit was with him and he followed me wholeheartedly. Kalev. But if you pronounce this word Caleb, it means dog. Isn't it interesting? The same word can have two such opposite meanings. Here's Caleb. Two out of all the men of Israel, one of the two men who lives through the 40 years in the wilderness, goes on in to conquer Canaan, receive his inheritance, the inheritance there at Hebron, where the graves of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are. This mighty man of God who followed God wholeheartedly. But if you take that wholeheartedness, and instead of pursuing God with it, and you pursue the world with it, as my son Caleb brought out in the Torah portion today, then you're like a dog. Dogs are wholehearted, you know. They're man's best friend. They just follow you wholeheartedly, but they're still dogs. They're considered unclean. So the question is, are you going to be Caleb, wholehearted, or are you going to be a Caleb, a dog? It's an interesting question. So anyways, back to our Torah portion. God says, they've tested me 10 times. Well, what are the 10 tests? This is the first time we see a number attached to these 10 testings. And the rabbis have tried to enumerate these 10 testings in different ways. But the Talmud seems to have the most accurate listing. And this is how the Talmud lists them. It's in Tractate Arachim. And it's in page 15 A and B, the 10 tests. And look how they're grouped. They say there are 2 tests at the sea. When they entered the Red Sea, they complained and said, "Why did you bring us out of Egypt?" But the Talmud says, and also when they came out of the Red Sea, there was a complaint about, okay, so we got out, but the Egyptians are still going to come get us. And that's when God closed up the sea. I think a better one is to go to Exodus 14, verse 12, and you see a second complaint. So 14:11 brings out one complaint, 14:12 brings out a second. So there are 2 complaints, 2 testings where they tested God there at the Red Sea. And then there are 2 testings concerning manna. God said, don't leave any of it until morning. It'll be stinking, filled with worms. And they left it till morning, and it was stinking, filled with worms. But he said, on Fridays, collect a double portion because I'm not going to send manna on the Sabbath. And I will make sure that that double portion from Friday will last to the Sabbath and won't be stinky and filled with worms. But a lot of them didn't gather a double portion, and they went on the Sabbath to gather, and there was no manna. So there are 2 testings in regard to manna. There are 2 testings in regard to quail. We touched upon these last week. They had a hunger for flesh there as they were coming to Mount Sinai. And then there was another hunger for flesh that we mentioned last week. And that second lust for flesh was much more expensive than the first one. Because the second time they lusted for flesh, many, many, many people died. God struck them. He might endure your fleshly appetites when you're immature, but after you've received his Torah and grown and seen God's works and walked with him, he expects that lust of the flesh to die. If it doesn't, you will. There were 2 concerning water. At Marah, they complained because the water was bitter. And then later at Massa and Meribah, which means temptation and testing, I believe that it is, or complaining and testing, I forget just how they're translated. There was no water, so that's when Moses struck the rock, and then the rock supplied water. So you see how these are all in pairs? 2 testings at the sea, 2 concerning manna, 2 concerning flesh, quail in particular, and 2 concerning water. But what are the other 2? They don't go in a pair. At least they don't seem to. What are the 2 biggies, the 2 big things where they really stretched God's patience almost to the breaking point, where they made him so angry he was ready to kill them all? What was the first one? The golden calf, Exodus 32. And then here, the evil report of the spies. Now, I think God is trying to tell us something here. He's telling us these 2, which take place a long time apart, over a year apart, they really are a menorah pattern. They're 2 halves of one thing. Think about it for a second. The golden calf. With the golden calf, God threatens to destroy them all and raise up from Moses a people. He does the same thing here after the evil report of the spies we just read. In both cases, Moses intercedes for the people, reminds God of his testimony, what the nations will say if he kills the people of Israel. In both cases, God relents and he forgives. In both cases, there's a cycle of 40 leading up to the test and a cycle of 40 following the test. With the golden calf, remember Moses went up on the mountain for 40 days and nights to receive the tablets. And when he came down, there they are, all sinning. He breaks the stone tablets. And after a few other things and some punishments and so on, he has to go up for another 40 days to receive the new tablets, right? Here, the evil report of the spies have just been touring the land for 40 days, correct? They come back, they give the evil report. What's God's punishment? You've delayed entering Canaan for 40 years. The 40 days Moses spent up on the mountain was ordained of God. The second 40 was a delay caused by the people's sin. The 40 days spent in the land of Canaan, exploring it, was permitted by God. But the 40 years of wandering is a delay that was a consequence of the people's sin. There's a whole lesson here, a whole teaching, but I'll leave it to you guys to explore that more. But there's another deeper similarity between these two. With the golden calf, the people are worshiping what is false. But with the evil report, they are fearing what is false. Because you see, what you fear and what you worship are really the same thing. We are commanded to fear God. We are commanded not to fear anything else. Because fear for the believer is illegal. Because anything you fear, you're saying it's a challenge to God. God's got competition here. Whatever you fear, you have elevated to the status of a God. Because your fear is to belong to God and to God alone. But when you fear something else, you have promoted it. And you've robbed God of what belongs to him. And you've given it to this other thing. You follow what I'm saying? You ask yourself honestly, what are the things in my life I fear? Those are your idols. Idolatry is alive and well among believers. And I'm not excluding myself. It is alive and well. But it needs to be dead. What are the things in your life you fear? Those are your idols. And God's a jealous God. And he's determined for your sake, for the sake of your soul, to bring destruction to those things. And those things will cause you nothing but pain and disappointment until finally you destroy them. Is that clear? You see, this golden calf thing and this evil report, this all came out of the people's ego. Remember the teaching when we talked about the ego? The ego is not pride. The ego is a phantom soul we construct around ourselves. And because we are so fearful of what people are going to say about us, we construct a soul around us that is of our own making. And then we defend it. It's the source of all of our unhappiness. It's the source of all of our anger. Because when people begin to poke holes in it and realize it's not real, we get very angry, very defensive. We pour more energy into the ego. We should let the ego dissipate. You want to see a man who has no ego? Look to Yeshua. Here's a man, there's no phantom soul about him at all. He was the real deal. He says, when you see me, you've seen the Father. There's nothing phantom or false about me. The second closest in the running is Moses himself. And this is why God used him as a deliverer, as a lawgiver. And I mean, no other person in Scripture is used as powerfully as Moses, because he was the most humble of all men. But you see, this golden calf, this evil report of the spies, is all based on the ego and this phantom soul. And when we live out of the ego, the phantom soul, we will worship a phantom God in a fleshly way. And we will fear phantom things. You'll worship things that don't exist, and you'll fear things that don't exist. But as you become more real, as you put the ego aside, God becomes more real. And those things you feared become just phantoms. They're just gone. The truly humble man does not get angry. The truly humble, unless he's defending God, unless he's defending something outside of himself, there is a righteous anger. Righteous anger, though, is always based on defense of another, not on defense of the self or the ego. But a truly humble man, anger is just not a part of his makeup. And fear is not a part of his makeup either. You follow what I'm saying? So if you want to do a great study, take these two events and study them very carefully. Exodus 32 and Numbers 14. Lay them side by side. Study them because they're two halves, two opposite halves of the same thing. And there's a lot of instruction there for us. So the question is this. The question is, little rabbi trail, why don't you answer, who are these people? What group of people do these adjectives describe? Unhappy, frustrated, fearful, anxious, disobedient, unfaithful. And by unfaithful, I mean not people who don't believe in God, but unfaithful people are people who measure everything around them by their own standard, by themselves. All right? Well, there's an obstacle. Instead of comparing the obstacle to God, they compare the obstacle to their own abilities. Deceived, angry, resistant to counsel, hard-hearted toward God. What group of people does that describe? People in our Torah portion, doesn't it? I'm sure we could think of a few others, but as I went through, I tried to think of adjectives to describe these people. But as I was reading this, I was struck by the fact that this is the group that was in the majority. Out of the 12 spies, 10 out of the 12 were this. Only two got it right. And then it says all the people of Israel fell in with the 10. Now, some of the women and children may have been exempted from that, because sometimes it says all the children of Israel. That can be a very figurative kind of phrase. It can sometimes mean most and not all, but we don't know. But then it caused me to ask a question. If this was the case with these people who had been redeemed from Egypt by the blood of the Lamb, who had passed through the sea, who had fed on the manna, who had drunk from the living waters from the rock, who had been protected by God by day and by night, who had received his word, is it possible that of the believers today, 10 out of 12 are this? Think of the believers you know in your life. All right, right now I'm going to excuse yourself. You don't have to put you in this group. Think of the believers you know in your life. Ask yourself, and I'm not saying this is the fact. I'm just kind of polling the group here. How many of them, what percentage of them that you know, would you say are described by these adjectives? And then how many of them are happy? They are at peace. They are courageous. They don't worry. They obey God with a full heart. They are faithful to Him. They know the truth, and because of that, they are free from entanglements. They are not angry when they're insulted. They listen to counsel. They seek out wise counsel. And they're soft-hearted toward God. They want His will above all. What percentage of the believers in your life that you're acquainted with are that? And again, I'm not pointing fingers, not making an accusation. I'm simply just asking the question, if this is true of these people, at that time, are we exempt somehow? I want us to look at three passages of Scripture, because this story of the spies is something that is reiterated and discussed throughout the Bible. Let's start with Psalm 95, and then we'll look at two New Testament passages. Psalm 95. Psalm 95, are we all there? Psalm 95, here we go. Oh, come, let us sing for joy to the Lord. Let us shout joyfully to the rock of our Yeshua, our salvation. Let us come before his presence with thanksgiving. Let us shout joyfully to him with psalms, for Adonai is a great God and a great king above all gods. Oh, that means there's a bunch of gods, right? Well, just a little footnote. Go to the next psalm, Psalm 96. Look at verse 5. For all the gods of the peoples are nothing. Okay, so there you go. So whenever you see those scriptures referring to other gods, just remember all the other gods are nothing. All right? If your translation says idols, the word there is still nothing. All right? So, verse 4, we'll go back to 95, we'll pick up with verse 4. In whose hand are the depths of the earth, the peaks of the mountains are his also. The sea is his, for it was he who made it, and his hands formed the dry land. I think that pretty much covers it all. Come, let us worship and bow down. Let us kneel before Adonai, our Maker, for he is our God. And we are the people of his pasture and the sheep of his hand, if today you would hear his voice. Now, translations do all kinds of things with this. They'll make today, if you would hear his voice, a separate sentence. And the Hebrew doesn't quite read that way. It can. But that today, if you would hear his voice, is kind of an odd line. And it seems to go best with the first part of verse 7. But it could equally go with verse 8. It's kind of hanging there, and I think David purposely made it hang. Because everything before this psalm is what life is like, what our perspective of life is like, if we will hear his voice. Everything after that phrase is what our life is like if we don't. So, This psalm is like sliced in half by these words. Today, if you would hear his voice, or if today you will hear his voice. Today, this moment. You know, one of the things I've noticed, I think there's something spiritual that's faster than the speed of light. And that is the ability for us to harden our hearts or to soften them. It's the work of an instant. Like that. We can harden it. Like that, we can soften it. It's strictly a decision we make with our will to decide, God, all right, I'm yours. Do with me what you want. Just that quick. Or it's like, no, I don't quite get it. It's just a split-second decision. So look what verses 8 through 11 say. Do not harden your hearts as at Meribah, as in the day of Massah in the wilderness. That's when there was no water and they whined and complained and Moses struck the rock and out came the living water. When your fathers tested me, they tried me, though they had seen my work. Now look at verse 10 and let this soak in. Are you ready? For 40 years I loathed that generation. Whoa, 40 years he loathed them? But for 40 years, he continued to provide manna every morning. For 40 years, he continued to provide living waters from that rock that Moses struck. For 40 years, he kept the cloud over the people to protect them and provided light at night. For 40 years, his presence still dwelt in the tabernacle in the midst of their presence. And yet for 40 years, he loathed them. You got to let this sink in. You can't let this one pass. Because, you see, God's presence in your life is not necessarily an indication of his favor in your life. In fact, God's blessings in your life may not be an indication of his favor. You may just be piggybacking on the blessings he's giving your parents, your spouse, your kids, your congregation. Ben and I were talking about this a little bit this week, and he says, you know, it sounds like spiritual welfare. I thought, I'm going to steal that line. Spiritual welfare, in other words, the people are doing no work, they're investing not one iota in the kingdom of God, but they're still just reaping the benefits. For 40 years, I loathed that generation. But he gave them manna, water, light, shade, tabernacle, Torah. They had all the things that we as believers covet. But he loathed them. And said, they are a people who err in their heart. In other words, on the outside, they might have been obeying the commandments, but in their hearts, they erred. And they do not know my ways. Caleb and Joshua did, but these people didn't. Therefore, I swore in my anger, truly they shall not enter into my rest. Yeah, I'll give them manna, give them water, give them protection, but they're not going to know rest in their souls. Now, we go to Hebrews. Let's go to the book of Hebrews. Let's start with chapter 3. The writer, whoever the writer is, comments extensively on Psalm 95, and he builds on it and brings out many more insights. So if we go to Hebrews chapter 3, let's look at verse 7. Therefore, just as the Holy Spirit says, and here he quotes much of that last half of Psalm 95. Today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as when they provoked me, as in the day of trial in the wilderness, where your fathers tried me by testing me and saw my works for 40 years. Therefore, I was angry with this generation and said, they always go astray in their heart. They did not know my ways. As I swore my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. And then he says, now he's writing to believers, all right? He's writing to believers. I'm assuming we all here are believers. So the people I know here, I know you are. He's writing to believers. He says, take care, brethren, that there not be in any one of you an evil, unbelieving heart that falls away from living God. In other words, yeah, you can accept Jesus as your Savior. You can believe you're going to heaven and will be. You can say this is the word of God. You can pray. You can serve. You can do this. And yet inside have an evil, unbelieving heart that falls away from living God. But encourage one another day after day after day after day after day after day, as long as it is still called today, so that none of you will be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. Sin comes along. It deceives us and says, I'm not really sin. I'm just an alternative way of living righteously. I'm not really sin. I may not be really righteous, but I'm allowed. He comes along and deceives us and says, all right, I'm sin, but you know, I'm a little one, not a big one. Everybody does it. It's acceptable. And every time we justify, this is what hardening the heart is, by the way. You want to know what hardening the heart is? It's not throwing God out. It's simply justifying your ways in place of his. That's what hardening the heart is. That's all it is. Hardening the heart is saying, okay, I know this is what God wants me to do, but you know what? I just got to do this other thing. And you harden your heart by the deceitfulness of sin. For we have become partakers of Messiah if we hold fast the beginning of our assurance firm until the end. While it is said, today if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as when they provoked me. For who provoked him when they had heard? Indeed, not all those who came out of Egypt led by Moses. In other words, it wasn't all the redeemed ones. And with whom was he angry for 40 years? Was it not with those who sinned, whose bodies fell in the wilderness? And to whom did he swear that they would not enter his rest, but to those who were disobedient? So we see that they were not able to enter in because of unbelief. They had enough faith to get them out of Egypt, but they didn't have enough faith to get them into Canaan. And that's where so many of us fall in the wilderness. The wilderness is not to be our home, and it is not to be our graveyard. It's to be a place of preparation for Canaan. So he continues, therefore let us fear. Here's the only exception to the place where we're not to fear. I have looked through the scriptures. I've tried to find anything in the Bible where it says we're to fear something other than God. This is the only exception right here, Hebrews 4, verse 1. Here's the one thing that we are to fear. And it itself is a form of fear of God. Therefore, let us fear if, while a promise remains of entering his rest, any of you may seem to have come short of it. Is there some area in your life that you have not rested firmly in God's promises? But you're still worrying over and taking control over and trying to fit it into your plans? Or have you surrendered it? You know, is there anything? Look for it. For indeed, we have had gospel preached to us, just as they also. I know you may say good news. What's the word gospel? And Hebrews talks about how the gospel is preached to Abraham. They knew the gospel, the good news of redemption. But the word they heard didn't profit them because it was not united by faith in those who heard. Now, faith and obedience are the exact same absolute total thing. Faith and obedience are the same thing. For we who have believed enter into that rest, just as he has said, as I swore my wrath, they shall not enter my rest, although his works were finished from the foundation of the world. For he has said somewhere concerning the seventh day, and God rested on the seventh day from all his works. And again in this passage, Psalm 95, they shall not enter my rest. Therefore, since it remains for some to enter it, and those who formerly had the gospel preached to them failed to enter because of disobedience. Now, up in verse 2, it says because it was not united with faith. Here he simply uses the word disobedience. Again, they're the same thing. He again, verse 7, fixes a certain day. Today, saying through David after so long a time, just as has been said before, today if you hear his voice. What he's saying is David wrote his psalm hundreds of years after the episode of the spies. But David is still saying today, you have the chance of doing right what the people of Israel got wrong. And now here's the writer of Hebrews, 1,000 years after David, saying, it's still today, if you'll hear. And you can correct what the Israelites did wrong. You have it in your hand to say, yes, I am going in. Or you can whine and complain about how you can't. Verse 8, for if Joshua had given them rest, he would not have spoken of another day after that. So there remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God. For the one who has entered his rest has himself also rested from his own works, as God did from his. Therefore, let us be diligent to enter that rest, so that no one will fall through following the same example of disobedience. In other words, we as believers in the 21st century are just as capable of committing the exact same sin as the Israelites did in Numbers 14. One more passage, and it's a short one. We'll go through it quickly. 1 Corinthians chapter 10. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 1. Anybody have a shotgun in their truck? They can go shoot out the siren at the fire station right now. 1 Corinthians 10. I'm just stalling for time, give you time to get there, okay? 1 Corinthians 10, verse 1. Now, here, this first statement, I've got to piggyback on. This is an amazing, a wonderful statement for us. Paul, the Hebrew of Hebrews, right? The Pharisee, is writing to Gentiles. And what does he say? For I do not want you to be unaware, brethren. All right? Here's the Jew, the Hebrew of Hebrews, who is writing to Gentiles and calling them his brothers. But then look what he says. I do not want you to be unaware, brethren, that our fathers, not my fathers, our fathers. You understand what he's doing here? He's saying you might be Gentiles in the flesh, but we are all in this covenant of Israel together. You're my brothers. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and those Israelites who came out of Egypt, they are our fathers, we are their children. You follow? Okay. They were all under the cloud, all passed through the sea, all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, all ate the same spiritual food, all drank the same spiritual drink, for they were drinking from a spiritual rock which followed them, and the rock was Messiah. Another, here's what Paul's saying in a nutshell. He's saying, your experience as a believer, their experience as believers being redeemed out of Egypt is the same experience. What God did for them and what God did for you is the same thing. Passover lamb, blood, faith, grace. Passover lamb of God, blood, faith, grace. It's the same thing. But then he says, verse 5, nevertheless, with most of them, not some, not a few, not half, most, circle most in your Bible, with most of them, God was not well pleased. For they were dropped, they were laid low in the wilderness. Now these things happened as examples for us, so that we would not crave evil things as they also craved. Do not be idolaters. He's talking to his believing brothers, and he tells them, do not be idolaters as some of them were. Verse 8, nor let us act immorally as some of them did. Verse 9, nor let us test the Lord as some of them did. Verse 10, nor grumble as some of them did. Verse 11, now these things happened to them as an example, and they were written for our instruction, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed that he does not fall. You think you stand? All right, then take heed. No temptation has overtaken you, but such as is common to man. And God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you're able, will with the temptation provide a way through, not escape. Scratch out escape, that's what you got. Lousy, worst, one of the worst translations of the King James that tend to stick to other translations. God's not interested in escaping. He's going through the testing. He'll provide an outcome, a way through also, so that you will be able to endure it. See, if you escape, then where's the endurance, right? If you go through it, come out the other end, you've endured it. Therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry. I speak as to wise men. You judge what I say. All right. I've come up with a little test. And it may not be the best, but it's close enough. You make adjustments for yourself. I want to ask you a question. And I don't care what the answers are. I don't want to raise it. I don't want to know. And honestly, I don't know the answer to this question. There's no way I could know the answer to this question. I can only answer it for myself. And I'm not even too sure what the answer is going to be. I have a pretty good idea. When I ask the question, immediately your heart is going to do one of two things. One, it'll either harden, and you'll justify your answer to the question, or your heart will rejoice. There'll be a warm glow there. You'll think, oh, I know the answer. I can't wait to get started on it, to continue with it. Here it is. When you leave the building, what are you going to do with the rest of this day? This is the Sabbath. This is a commandment to rest on this day, to guard it, keep it holy, don't do any work. You, your family, that's the commandment. And you all know, if you've ever been here, you know it's as valid today as it was the day it was given. It has never been changed to another day. It has never been taken away. In fact, it's the only commandment of the ten where Yeshua says, I am the Lord of this one. You want to know my presence? This is the one. And it's an eternal decree, the Bible tells us. And if Paul's right, we've been grafted in. And the fathers are our fathers. So, what are you going to do with the rest of the day? Is it going to be resting in the Lord, enjoying your family, really physically getting and absorbing true rest in your body, your soul, your spirit. Just relishing and reveling in this incredible foretaste of the world to come. Is that what you're going to do? Or is it going to be working on the car, a sporting event, gardening, shopping? And now, what happens if your heart rises up to justify your plans for the day, which are not in accordance with the scriptures? And again, I don't know who you are, so I can't point fingers at anybody and say you're bad or you're wrong or you're sinning. If you say, but you know, I just have to work today. I just have to go make this money. In other words, there are walls around those cities there, aren't there? Big walls to get through. Well, you don't understand. My family doesn't understand, and my kids have things they have to do, and I have to get them to. Oh, so you're telling me there are some giants in the land? Well, you know what? If I don't take this day and do with this what I've got to do, I'm just not going to survive. Oh, this is a land that devours its people. See, I know you don't know how you could possibly, if you haven't been keeping the Sabbath, you don't know how you could possibly do so and still survive. Because it makes no sense. I'll be the first to admit, keeping the Sabbath makes no logical sense. But then traipsing around the wall, Jericho and tooting on shofars, making walls, I don't know how that works either. But I know if you honor God, He'll honor you. If you make His will, He'll make your will His will. Entering His rest. The writer of Hebrews is not talking just about some spiritual rest, although that is part of it. He's talking about the seventh day. Because you see, the seventh day is the wedding ring between God and His people. And I'm just using this commandment just as an example. I could probably pick out a bunch of different ones, but I thought, let's pick this one. Because I have no idea what the answers are for any of you. But you know what the answer is. Now, some of you may have a legitimate excuse. That's wonderful. That's wonderful. You know, and God may say, you know, that's a good excuse. If you're in the medical field or law enforcement or something where people's lives are on the line, by all means, if there's an ox in the ditch, you're commanded to go get them out. I don't care if it's a Sabbath day. But again, it's a question you have to answer. Something for you to wrestle with. Something for you to check your heart against. And ask yourself, God, is my heart unbelieving? Is there a flavor of idolatry in my life? Am I hard-hearted toward you? I don't know. And the reason I can ask this question is because I am not the Shabbat police. I don't know what anybody's going to do. And you know, if we're talking tomorrow or next week and you said, oh yeah, we went to the mall. Oh yeah, I weeded the garden and put in my tomatoes or whatever on Shabbat, I will not condemn you. I will love you. You know what? I've gotten so over people doing whatever. I don't even, the thought doesn't even go through my heart. Like, oh, you shouldn't do that. You're not going to get any condemnation from me. I promise you. I promise you, as God's my witness, you're not going to hear it from me. I'm not going to do it. But you see, I am commanded to encourage you day after day after day after day after day after day to follow after the Lord. I want us to be like Joshua and Caleb, who are a different spirit. And they are out of step with their entire generation, where they were in step with God. You see? Don't look around and say, well, I'm in the majority. And Grant, you're in the minority. I love being in the minority if I'm in with Joshua and Caleb. You see? I would take that any day. I don't want my carcass to drop in the wilderness of frustration as a believer. I'm going to live a fruitful Christian life. A fruitful messianic Jewish life. You see, coming out of Egypt, the people didn't have to fight. They didn't have to lift a finger to fight. God did all the fighting for them. But going into Canaan, the fighting's all yours. God's with you. But you take your arms, you have to fight. And we don't like that. We want the easy way. We want spiritual welfare. So God challenges us to be warriors. There's no glory in being an infant. but a daughter of the king, a son of the king. Ah, that's what the glory is. And to do that, we have to walk in his steps. And he's given us weapons. Let's take them up. He's given us rest. Let's enjoy it. All right? We've gone over. So let's that siren be going off a second time if we don't quit. So let's close in prayer. Father, thank you for this time. And Lord, I pray that no word that I have spoken would be heard as a word of condemnation. Challenge, yes. Condemnation, no. That's not my job. I am not the judge. Lord, I want to encourage my brothers and sisters and myself, for I fail so often. Just encourage us on to good works, and so much the more as we see the day approaching. For we know we live in the last days, when the prophecy is being fulfilled, that the spirit of Elijah will return the hearts of the children to the fathers. So, Lord, I pray we would live lives like Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, who followed you, and in the midst of their failings, they picked themselves up and followed you again. Lord, let us be like them, for they live their lives in the land of promise, the land of Canaan, and you're asking us, as you did the children of Israel, to return there. Help us to do so, Father, and you will help us, for this is your desire, and you'll blow down the walls of the shofar. You'll defeat our enemies and make them flee from our presence. It will just be obedient to you. So, Lord, help us to fear you and to fear any promise left us of entering into your rest that we should fall short of. But, God, do not let us fear the enemy and the challenges ahead. They don't deserve our fear. Only you do. And we praise you that you've called us to this calling in Yeshua's name. Amen.